My name's Murray. I am an alcoholic. I learned that from a woman in Current River Group who sat across from me and always looked straight at me. And she said, always. That was her inflection. I am an alcoholic. The emphasis was on the am. And she had 20-some years, and I was brand new. And it took me about 3 years to get up the courage to ask her, why do you say it like that? And she said, I came in once a long time ago, and I relapsed. And I say it that way because I need to remember that today I am an alcoholic. And ever since I've said my introduction that I am an alcoholic, I've not had to have another drink of alcohol. That credit is due to this program, to the fellowship I found in the rooms of AA, and to the sponsorship I eventually took advantage of. I come from a small, well, by Atlanta standards, a very small town of Thunder Bay, Ontario, 100,000 people. I live in a section of Thunder Bay that holds about 5,000 people. And we're surrounded, we're sort of separated from the rest of the city by a river, a lake, another river, and by Lake Superior on the other shore, on the other side. So we're quite a village. In that village, when I started drinking, I thought I knew what I was doing, and no one else did. You know how that is? I found out after I quit drinking that almost everyone who knew me knew there had been a change. And they would often bring it up to me. Murray, you look so good. And I'd say, who are you? I've lived behind you for 15 years in the house. There were lots of those new acquaintances that I made once I was sober. But for a vision for you, when I came into AA, Heidi talked about the vision we have before we come into AA, and I knew I had lost that one. There was never going to be that vision that I had of Murray, who was able to drink and do whatever he wanted over anybody else's objection. That was never going to be. Instead, I had a new vision of Murray, who was never going to drink, never going to have any more fun, going to have to go to meetings forever and ever and ever. And there was a lot of fear in that. A lot of fear. I had grown up with fear. And I thought that coming into AA that that would change. But initially it did not. I had all new kinds of fear. I didn't want to open up because I was afraid that since this AA was the last house on the block for me, if I opened up, that you would say, we don't want you. That fear was greater than my need to be honest with you. It took 10 years for me to finally open up in AA. By that time, I had had a sponsor, and he was wonderful with me. He helped me to understand that no matter what age, no matter what religion, no matter what color of skin, no matter what job I used to have, none of that mattered in AA. What really mattered was that I could relate to the other alcoholics as an alcoholic. That was a revelation for me. I thought I had to impress. That ain't true. As I began to get honest, my vision changed. My fear of opening up was much reduced. Not all gone, but much reduced. I found I'm a single man, and they have a line in our literature about those who are unable to enjoy a family life, that they too can find a joy of living in doing service, that those with families, married in families, would otherwise not be able to. So I got into service. I had real trouble going out for coffee with people that I really didn't know, and they would do that social chit-chat. You know what I mean? I had about 3 nanoseconds of social chit-chat. And after that, I was so uncomfortable, I would get up and leave. It took me a long time. Look at me now. Holy cow. I want to thank a little volunteer here in an L.A. hat for getting me the water. It's so comfortable here. I'm so impressed. As I grew in AA and got into service, it was at the group level first. Secretary, I work in a college. I know how to take notes. I was secretary at Current River. Then I became treasurer. I couldn't balance my own checkbook, but by golly, I learned how to balance the checkbook for Current River. Mainly out of fear, right? Because it wasn't my money, it was their money. So I learned how to do that, and I learned how to accept criticism and answer honestly back what was going on. Big service skill for Murray. As I went on in service, I got involved in the local intergroup, and I did secretary, treasurer. Is this sounding repetitious? I did that all the way through service. Secretary, treasurer, and then to another table position. Those skills built. I was eventually chair of the local intergroup, and somewhere along the line, they asked me to join area service because they couldn't find a secretary. And I knew how to do that. So I joined as secretary. I was really worried because I had never been in GSR. And they said, well, you'll do. As secretary, I got to meet delegates. I was one of those who held a delegate in awe. I thought they knew everything. How many of you know delegates? How many of you think they know everything? Not a hand went up, right? Eventually, I too became a delegate, and I found out how much I didn't know. And I had to start learning all over again. The vision I had of AA expanded from my home group to the intergroup because I was meeting representatives from the groups in our city, and then to the district, and then to the area. And as a delegate, I got to meet people, other delegates from other areas in the whole of U.S. and Canada. It really expanded my vision of what AA is. In that position, I had to go back to my area and carry what was the results of our conference deliberations back to our area groups. That put me in front of a microphone. Believe me, in our area, if I said anything wrong at the microphone, I was going to hear it. And I would hear it from them real soon. So again, Murray became honest and open, and I learned to talk to other alcoholics about what pertains to Alcoholics Anonymous and to carrying the message. That's what service is about. I thought it was about the trips. The trips hadn't ended. See, when I was drinking, one of my visions was of Murray in the civil service for Canada, sitting on the banks of some river in Paris or Berlin, and drinking an aperitif after a hard day at the office. That vision stuck in my mind, and I thought that was one of the things that was never going to happen. My area chose me to be the nominee for Trustee at Large Canada. We had just had a trustee elected who rotated out in the year that I was being nominated. And I knew that lightning would not strike twice. My God has a funny sense of humor. And I was elected as Trustee at Large Canada. And in that position, the Trustee at Large Canada and the one elected from the U.S. are the ones who are designated to travel on behalf of the Fellowship of Canada and the United States as a representative of the General Service Board. And in that position, I was able to travel and to meet other AAs in celebrations or at their board meetings in 13 other countries. My dream as an active alcoholic came true for me through doing service in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a paradox in there somewhere. All I know is that in that travel, I gained a whole new vision of AA. And let me tell you about one of those trips. I attended a meeting in Mongolia. Mongolia is a country that sits to the northeast of China. How are we doing for time?
Good.
When I traveled there, I had looked on the map to see where it was. I had tried real hard to pronounce their capital, Ulaanbaatar. That's as good as I can make it. When I traveled there, we were to attend, the general manager of the General Service Office and myself, we were to attend the first national convention of the representatives of all of the groups in Mongolia. There were some 60 delegates there, and they represented their groups. The groups were not organized into districts or areas. They had not developed their structure. At that meeting, we brought with us five pamphlets we generally have as our first pamphlet to a new alcoholic, information about on Alcoholics Anonymous, what is AA for you. The difference was that these pamphlets were printed in the language of Mongolia. Let me set the scene for you. We're sitting in a large, round canvas, actually a felt canvas, tent. And the delegates are sitting in a semicircle around the head table like this. And there were three rows of 10 seats each. And they started handing out the gift from the General Service Office of the United States and Canada. It was a gift from us to them. And they started the pamphlets moving at this end, just like we do in school. Take one and pass it on, right? Take one and pass it on. And as the pamphlets were passed across, the first one to get it hollered out to the next one, "It's in our language." And the noise began. "It is, it is, it is, it is." And as they began reading and believing, seeing is believing, and they turned to the head table because it had been told to them that it was our gift to them. And they started to clap. And they didn't stop for a long time. And I stood there, and as I look out at you, I give that back to you. That was your gift to them. And it continues to be our gift. And the money we put in the hat goes to our group, then our district, then our area, and then to our General Service Office. And the General Service Board uses that money, some of that money, to translate and to pass on literature in their own language to all of the countries who want to hear about Alcoholics Anonymous. Absolutely. With your contributions, you translate that dollar into the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in a language that the alcoholic in other countries can read and understand and come to us for the help that we know is available. I wish you every success. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Murray, and thank you for your service. Next, I'd like to welcome our second speaker, Vivian F. from Orlando, Florida. Whoa. I'm a little shorter. I'm going to break the thing. Hi, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Vivian. Hi, family. My sobriety date's May 15th, 1992.
Yeah, that's cool, right?
I have to tell you, you know, I don't know if you remember that first day you went to kindergarten and you started walking in that room and you're holding your mommy's hand and you feel that fear and intrepidation in your tummy and you feel that excitement because you're going to walk through that door and open to a whole new world.
Today is like the first day of kindergarten for me. This is absolutely amazing. You know, I have to tell you that, to be completely honest, this is not my favorite chapter in the big book.
So I did what everybody told me to do, and you have always said to me that if I needed help, to ask. So I started asking. I started, you know, what is this about? You know, what is a vision for you? So people started willingly helping me out with my journey with a vision for you. Yesterday, I sat in one of my other favorites, what was the varieties of a religious experience, and I had a religious experience. And as I sat there listening to the speakers, I felt this overwhelming feeling, and I began to tear up. And I realized that this is not a vision for you, it is a vision for me. And I'm here to share what that vision is for me. You know, Bill talked, you know, I can hardly see up here. Bill talked about King Alcohol in the chapter. And, you know, King Alcohol for me was that feeling that, you know, that it took me to a place where I didn't have to worry about anything. When I first started drinking at the age of 15, I didn't get that overwhelming feeling about how great I was going to feel now and I could dance and I could speak well. What happened with me is for the first time, I could sleep. Because of trauma that I had experienced at a young age, I would not sleep at night. I kept the lights on and kept my eyes open as long as I could until I would just fall. And alcohol did that for me. It helped me to now just go into oblivion. So from that beginning, I found out that I could use this alcohol in other ways. And so then I did learn now that this person that couldn't look you straight in the face at all, that couldn't even carry on a single sentence without, you know, stumbling over my words, which I still do, I use this alcohol to all of a sudden become that person that gave that false courage. So my vision, this vision, started becoming not a vision and not a pleasant vision. It took me, as the book says, to sordid places. And they weren't pleasant. They weren't pretty. They were that part that it talks about, that when we go down into that hell and we find those four horsemen, that's where I was. You know, I was very unhappy, oblivious, angry. I was everything that you could imagine and then some. Could you hand me my glasses? I'm finding out that it's not the light that I'm having a problem with up here. It's I forgot my eyes. When I came up here, I brought my two best friends, which is, well, actually, they're my three best friends. I brought Bill and Bob, and I brought William James. So I have the varieties of that religious experience, and I have the words that have given me what I have today. A Vision for You talks about having that experience as we've gone through the book, and we've learned the things about us. Well, for me, it was. And I was taken into the steps. And I started learning that there was other ways to lead my life without having to run out and dress in inappropriate ways, behave in inappropriate ways. I learned that there was something else, but I didn't know the rules. And rules to me were really important. And now I focus on that because if I couldn't have a rule, I couldn't learn how to walk straight. I couldn't learn how to act. So I needed this substitute in my life called rules. What I found out that there aren't any rules. It's called the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wondered, what is that fellowship? And it says it right here in A Vision for You. It tells me. It's so exciting. I just can't stop, you know? It says, there you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. I am fired up with Alcoholics Anonymous, what it's done for me. It says in here, how is that to come about, you ask? Where am I to find these people? And here you are. Who knew? One of the things that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is not so much to focus on who I used to be, but on who the person is that I'm becoming. I have to remember who I was to know who I'm becoming, but I don't focus on that person. And today, what I look at as I become this new vision for me is I can, if I make a mistake, it's a good thing. If I don't make a mistake, it's a good thing. You know, so it doesn't really matter anymore. It's because what I have found in this time through Alcoholics Anonymous is that I'm acceptable to me who I am today. And that's one of the big things it talks about in this chapter. We learn to like who we are. If I can't learn to like who I am, I can't love you and I can't love my neighbor. I can't work a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It tells us that. I have to love me to love you and I have to love you to love me. It's exciting. Bill and Ebby had their visit. This was exciting to me. I was listening to this speaker. Well, it was whatever it was. But it was Bill speaking at the Toronto convention, which, by the way, is where they had the first panorama picture. So it's exciting. And he's saying in this thing, he says, listen to this. This is amazing to me. He says, as he listened to Ebby, when Ebby came to his house, in his head, as he's still drinking, he said, he crossed a kinship of a common suffering. Oh my God, what is that like to still be drinking and know that there's a common suffering that's here in this program that's being brought to you? Jeez, Gads, I just amazing. It melts my heart. And then he says, it was divine link with cords of love. Wow. I could never thought like that when I was drinking. But what he was already feeling, and that's what, after I started going through the steps, and I went through step three, which I failed, I had to do twice, my sponsor said, you know, obviously I was having some problems turning a wheel over. And then I went in through 4 and 9, and I spent the time in there really learning and giving up those things and making amends and giving back. And 10, 11, 12, working with others. And there is the key for me as I began to work with others. I couldn't give you anything if I didn't have anything. And I learned this from someone I really appreciate in my life today. I can't give you what I don't have. How do I do that? How do I get that? What is it? You know, this is some of the things that I've had to learn about myself. I don't know what it is. Nobody gave that to me. Well, they gave it to me plenty of times. They didn't explain it to me. So I had to investigate that. Well, you know, one of the it's was yesterday when I sat in that room and I listened to those three speakers talk about their experience with God. And I realized that it's what it is my experience. That is my spiritual awakening. And what it is that I give is what that spiritual awakening was to me, I give back to you. And I can only do that by having the willingness to share the fears and the uncertainties and the things that happened to me as I walk this journey through Alcoholics Anonymous. Fear, I still have fear today. On a regular basis, I was fearful. I said to a friend, I was in my room having a divine discussion with God about fear. You know, I had this fear. I was in an elevator one time. This is sober. And there was this person, a law person, standing next to me with a gun. I was terrified. I had a terrible, probably a healthy fear of guns. I embarrassed myself in this elevator, which I couldn't get off of. And he's standing there with his gun. And I knew I needed help. And I reached out to a friend that had this knowledge that could give it to me. And he wrote back. And what he said was, I will walk you through fear to faith. What awesome words to have someone give to you when you're so full of fear and you know you need that help. And so he taught me how to shoot a gun. Hello? And I felt, when I look back on that, I feel bad for him because The fear that day as he was teaching me was just coming out of my body. The sweat was pouring out. I must have not been a vision at all. But what I learned from that, you know, and where it took me, and that fear. So it showed me that even though I can be afraid, I can reach out and I can get that help through you all, because that's what you've given to me. When you told me to use the steps and to use this book, and sometimes I've been in classes, in meetings, where we've been told to read line by line, and I find out that there's more printing in this book than I've known that was in there before. And so recently, I was given this information in this book by reading it, which is really kind of interesting that they rewrote this book sometime when I was sleeping. And I found out that in the second step, you know, when we talked about the insanity, well, if you read this book and the family afterward, it tells me that I have a miracle of mental health. Wow. Who thought that that would be my vision? It was not something I expected. But I'm latched on to that. That's one of my favorite passages now. Since it's been there and it's underlined and it's glowing, you know. But isn't it amazing when we come into these rooms and don't have a vision nor our vision, and then become a miracle of mental health? Who in their right mind would have ever told us something like that? Well, Bill, of course. Bill says that we enjoy our friends of science, we enjoy our friends of religion, and we have a lot of respect for these people because they gave us something that we didn't. We think that we got it in AA, but Bill said, no, we got it from our friends of science and our friends from religion. And that was the missing link that was needed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was what he took to Bob. And that was one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. William James' stories in the varieties of religious experience talk about this all the time, about when people were stuck against the wall, what could they do to get off? It took somebody else to come to them and help them. And that's what Bill said. That was the missing link that we needed in AA, and that's what saved him that day when he went to that phone to make a phone call and when he found Dr. Bob. And I look at that and I think, what a journey to think that this is, when he said he was 30 years sober, he looked and he said, this program is actually 33 years old on that day in 1965 when he made that declaration, because he respected those people, those friends of AA that we learned from. We could not have a vision if we did not have the people that are our friends that gave us this fellowship along the way, and Bill and Bob cemented it together for us. Thank God that he was paying attention. I'll close my eyes because I'm like running out of space here. 6 minutes. What can I do for 6 minutes? Okay. You know, I'm going to tell you a story. There was a time when I was first getting sober. I quit drinking on April 18th. I surrendered on May 15th, and that's my sobriety date. But I was in this treatment program for my son, of course, because it wasn't my problem. And that's where I actually got 12-stepped for the first time, and someone reached out that hand and gave that willingness to me to show me who I was and give me an opportunity to learn. And at that program, one of the things we'd do is you'd had to sit in this group, and, you know, women on one side or moms on one side, dads on the other, and help each other. It was a peer-on-peer type of program, which we do here, go figure. And I'm standing up in group, and we're talking about the fourth step, and the facilitator, who had just got married, I said, you know, well, of course it's not my fault. It's that person's fault from my past, from when I was a child. And he said, but where are you wrong? I'm like, what? I was the victim. What are you talking about? Where was I wrong? And I had somebody, and one of my peers shared to me, said, you know, you're not the victim now. It is not happening to you today. And I go back and I share that part of me with my sponsees and anybody else that wants to understand how to let go of that and grow in the person that I can become today because I'm willing to let go of that. I could not see that vision that I have to give back if I couldn't have had that opportunity to let go of being that victim. I held that tight. You know, I did not want to let go. I didn't know. I didn't know how it was holding me back. It was through this program and working with others. Those people worked with me so that I could work with others. And because of that, I've been able to give that to many sponsees. I thought it would be the most embarrassing thing in my life. I've learned that it's actually one of the best things in my life. So I've taken, like it says in here, these things that have happened to me, and I've seen now some of the positives that come from the fact that they happened to me. They just happened, and God doesn't make any mistakes. And I am going to finish, because to me, I probably am. Oh, my best friend fell. But what I want to leave you with is this thing. Bill talks about this in Vision for You. He talks about the people we've become. I am not who I think I should be today. I am not the person that I think I want to be today. But every day, I thank God that I am not that person I used to be. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Vivian. It's wonderful to share such enthusiasm and excitement. And one of the things in this chapter that is always quoted at the end is how we will surely meet some of you as we trudge the road of happy destiny. And it's so easy to think of that word trudging. It's just, you know, trudging. It's so serious and it's just trudging and, you know, it's drudgery. And it's exactly the opposite of what we're hearing from these speakers. And I learned one time that a great definition of trudging is just to walk with purpose. And that it's possible to skip with purpose or to cartwheel with purpose or to just walk joyfully with purpose. And let's welcome up our final speaker, Gregory from Powder Springs, Georgia.
There's a hole in my sidewalk. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes me a long time to get out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in my sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know it's there. It is my fault. I get out immediately. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in my sidewalk. I walk around it. My name is Greg and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. I wish I could take credit for that poem by Portia Nelson. When I found that poem, I fell in love with it. I've always been fascinated with poems. And when I got the call to speak at this meeting, well, actually, I got the email. I had just got in. It was a long day. A good day. And I immediately emailed it to about two or three of my good friends, including my sponsor who's here, and those other good friends that are here today. And I know this is a program of attraction rather than promotion, but I will go ahead and admit I promoted this meeting just a little bit. It was such a little bit that some of you I just met a few hours ago just found out about this meeting. Thank you all for being here. Thank you all. When I saw the title of the meeting, I just had so many different thoughts about what to say and what to do, and I was sharing with Claire that my immediate response was to do some research, you know, document this and give you all of these great quotes and stuff. And finally, the words of my sponsor and so many of you said, keep it simple. So I threw away the notes, read chapter 11 about three times again, and thought about the vision that I had before I even started drinking. I have always been a dreamer, and I thought it was a curse, as a matter of fact. As a little boy, I had a dream that lasted for over a year. Now, I come from a family, I have four siblings, two older and two younger. I never met my father. Well, I met him, but I don't remember meeting him. I was 18 months old when my father died, and he died from alcoholism. But back in that day, my folks said he just drank too much. So when I got sober, I went on this quest to diagnose my father's illness. When they found him, he was laying across the railroad tracks on his way home from work. The autopsy said that he had more alcohol in his body than what his liver could metabolize. I think that's what the doctors call alcoholism. But he never made it to this program. They say he was a good guy. Unlike my stepfather, who was very violent when he drank, he said he never fought my mother. He just was a jolly old guy. He drank a lot. He worked hard. He played hard. So I think a lot of my visions came from my early childhood. I was just one of those guys, you know, I used to say, you know, Leave It to Beaver, you know, Dennis the Menace, you know, those kind of guys. But I was way worse than that, you know. In the chapter 11, Bill talks about the four horsemen: bewilderment, terror, frustration, despair. I didn't know what they were then, but I know I was coupled with all of them now that I look back. And I think alcohol probably saved my life, along with a few other little commodities that I used to use, you know. So growing up, I had a lot of hatred for my stepfather because he was violent to my mother. I would have dreams that, I guess visions, that one day I would come home and they wouldn't be there. So I had a lot of fear. You know, I've heard several acronyms in this program about fear. I'm sure you've probably heard of some of them. I won't say that word, but I know you're thinking it. The effing and all that kind of stuff. But the one I really like that I don't mind sharing with you, the acronym for fear is Future Events Appearing Real. And that's what paralyzed me. The fear paralyzed me. I stayed busy as a young boy with the YMCA. That was about the only safe place my mother would agree to send me. So she renewed my membership every year. And plus, everybody knew her at the YMCA. And she knew that she would get a full report on me. So I traveled with the YMCA as a 11, 12, 13-year-old little boy who was filled with fear had these visions of coming home one day and my family wouldn't be there. Maybe killed, or my stepfather had done something crazy to them and I wouldn't see them anymore. But I refused to let anybody see me cry. I wouldn't tell anyone that. But those visions turned into nightmares. As I said, I had a dream that lasted for over a year. It was a terrible, terrible dream. Every time it got dark, I feared going to bed because that dream would pick up where it left off the night before. And my family, traditionally, old school, they didn't believe in Ritalin, thank God, because I qualified. Really didn't believe in psychiatrists and psychology and all this kind of stuff. But they had gotten to the point where they were willing to take me to a psychiatrist. My dream was that this one lady owned all of the children in the world. And I was her favorite for some reason. I don't know, I was grandiose even in the dream, you know. Every day she would march us up and down the streets all over the world. Every time somebody wanted to buy me, because she sold us. I guess we were like slaves, I don't know. But anyway, that's what I thought. This one woman had all the children in the world. And every time someone offered to purchase me, she refused to sell me. She said, no, that's one of my good workers. I can't get rid of him. And I wanted to get away from this lady. So one day I'm out in the yard. My mother is playing in her 4 o'clock flowers. I'm sitting on the ground playing with my bumblebees. We used to catch bumblebees in mason jars and then shake them like crazy and cripple them so they couldn't fly and then watch them suffer. You know? Well, at least what I used to do. I don't know. So I was playing with my bumblebees and this lady comes walking down the sidewalk. And my mother's name is Lucy. She says, hello, Lucy May, how are you doing? And I looked up and I broke out into tears and I screamed and I ran to my mother and I said, Mom, that's the lady in my dream. And she said, okay, go on in the house. I'll be in there in a minute. So she talked to the young lady. I'm in the house screaming, peeping out the window, making sure, you know, she doesn't come in and all that kind of stuff. My mother brings her in and then she calls me into the front room and she asked me to sit beside the lady, and she introduced her to me, and she said, this is a nice lady. And she had already told the lady what was going on with me. But what she did at that point is turn my dreams and my visions and what I thought was a reality into a realism, something I've never forgotten. So I was able to go from what I thought was real to something that was very real. Now, as a child, it didn't resonate at first, but over the years, when I think about that more and more, it brings me back to the acronym, Future Events Appearing Real, and how fear has paralyzed my life, or had, and sometimes I still get stuck a little bit, but how real the fear is, not the vision, so to speak, or not the dream. So anyway, when I thought about, you know, these four horsemen, bewilderment, terror, frustration, despair, what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I get up one day at a time with the grace and the humility as much as I can, and I ask God for another day. But I try to thank Him more than anything. And like my pastor used to say, he said, if I forgot something to thank you for, I want to thank you for that too, just in case I miss somebody or miss something, you know. So each day I try to suit up and show up. I told Murray when he first came in, I said, I was going to wear a tie. I guess I can put mine on now. And he said, that's what I was told in Alcoholics Anonymous, to suit up and show up. I was taught the same thing, but I took the tie off. Anyway, I want to thank everybody who's here today for showing up. This is my fifth international. I got started early in my sobriety date is March 23rd, 1990. I sobered up, finally, after two treatment centers, a lot of hospitals and a lot of jails in Oakland, California. We were a Navy family. We were stationed in Alameda. So I thank you for your service. So I got sober in Merritt Perot Institute in downtown Oakland, 30-day program. And I was so smart that I tried to show everybody how I could still drink and not use everything else. That lasted for about a year. It lasted through getting beat up twice, and I still have the scar from the last beating with the baseball bat. Foothill in 73rd, those of you who know Oakland, I don't have to say anymore. I wanted to prove to you guys that I was different when I got here. That was the vision that I had. I knew by now for sure they'd have another chapter in this book that was dedicated to me. Because I was just that different. And I wanted to be different. And I remember this young lady that was in the meeting. She had some other diagnosis, but she was very firm in her walk in AA. And she would always tell me, "You have big, beautiful eyes, honey. Keep coming back." I knew I had big eyes, but I didn't know they were beautiful. But she would tell me that over and over again because I would sit in the back room of the meeting. And I was determined to change Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a posse. It was about five or six of us. We'd sit in the back and we'd say things like, "I'm a drunk and I'm a dope fiend. Pass." I say, "Keep coming back." The stories compared to the visions or the dreams that I had were so unique in a way that I never would have imagined. Because I was able to feel and see the pain that the little blonde-headed, you know, the little school teachers who have the, I think they call it bouffant or something like that, the little blue hair with the purple streaks in it. And those are the types of ladies that I saw in my first meetings. And I'm saying, really? They're not, they didn't rob and steal and cuss and fight like me. You know, they look too, they're still driving Cadillacs, you know. But when I heard their stories, I identified. Some of us get here through jails and institutions. Some of us just wreck the Cadillac in the garage. You know, so it doesn't matter. The pain was the same that drove us here. That was my vision, to be able to identify. And that happened here in Alcoholics Anonymous through people like you. My sponsor immediately started taking me through the steps. I remember my first real joyous moment and this vision that I had that I was restoring my family. Everybody would love me. And sometimes I talk too much. So I attended this meeting on a Saturday afternoon on the campus of Berkeley University in California. It was an afternoon meeting. It was the first meeting that I'd ever been to where everybody who shared had to walk up to the platform and share. It's an hour and a half meeting. California has long meetings. Most of you know that. This lady who shared talked about her infidelity, her promiscuity. She talked about the affairs that she had. And I said, oh, my goodness, I'm not alone. Because, you know, after a drink, you know, I mean, you know, the drink came first, though, you know. Then, you know, I'm looking, how you doing, darling? So she talked about this in a way that just blew me away. I get home that afternoon, and we had dinner. My wife is already in the bed waiting on me. I jump into bed, and she's sitting up watching a program. And I said, she said, why are you so jolly? You've been so up today and everything. And I said, well, baby, she said, what happened at the meeting? And I said, darling, I said, the meeting was so good. She said, what did they talk about? I said, they talked about having affairs and things like that. And she said, well, what about you? How many have you had? And I said, oh, shit. And I thought about my sponsor saying honesty, open-mindedness, willingness. And I knew enough about the fourth step to just say, well, you know, I think I've had a few. So that even didn't go like I thought it went. But anyway, that was also part of my vision. I want to close. I've always been fond of poetry and music and songs. In my first year in sobriety, in 1990, I wrote this song I dedicated to my mother who passed a little over 3 years ago. And I entitled this poem, Hardhead. If I could see what life would be before I lived it out, would I accept the things I saw, unquestioned, without a doubt? There's no need to lie. I can't fool myself. I couldn't if I tried. I spend my wills trying to figure it out until the day I died. Now, Mom would always say the things that I needed to hear, but what a shame I had a big forehead and didn't absorb the fear. But now I know that she was right. Her experience tells it all. I thought that I was like an eagle and that I'd never, ever fall. So now we talk of things gone by and wish for new beginnings. She reminds me of the things she said and how it would be ending. Now time is zooming like a racing car, and now I'm on my own. I must admit I had much to learn, but being a fool is all I had shown. When searching for strengths and symbols unveiled, I've often bumped my head, because if I'd seen what life would have been, my thoughts would have been, I'm dead. Now glancing on the bookcase of life and touching the ones I've read, I wonder how I've made it this far with such a hard, hard head. Thank you.